Hello, everyone, and welcome to Actual Fluency Podcast 133, the podcast for language learners and aspiring polyglots, where we talk to some of the world's best language learners and top polyglots as well. Today, I'm joined by Miroslav Shedovy, and actually, Miro has been listening to the show since the beginning. He came up to me at the first polyglot gathering in Berlin 2014, which he helped organize, and he showed me his phone with the terrible Actual Fluency Podcast logo on it. It's still terrible, but hopefully we'll get to that at some point. And ever since, he's been really supportive at every event I've met him, and he sent loads of emails of support and suggestions, and even told me when there were some things that weren't working or some things that I could improve on. So I really appreciate him and what he's done for the community as well as for the Actual Fluency Podcast, because I am actually quite sure that I would never have made it to 133 episodes if it wasn't for Miro. So I owe him a lot, and if you guys like the podcast, then you definitely also owe him. He's big influence on the show. So I'm happy to finally get a chance to sit down with him and listen to his origin story, because it's just really fascinating. So before I just let you go with the recording here, I just want to thank this show's sponsor, which is Glossika. Glossika provide audio programs in more than 50 languages, and you can get started for free at tryglossika.com. And if you enjoy it, it's a monthly subscription service, but you do get access to all of the languages in that price, so you don't have to pay separately for each language, which just makes it a really awesome polyglot tool if you are just above beginner level. I wouldn't recommend trying it if you're just starting out, but if you have some experience in the language you want to learn, definitely go to tryglossika.com and give it a shot. And now for today's main segment. So, Miro, it's been a long time coming, but you're finally here. You finally agreed to come on the podcast and share your story with the listeners. So why don't we just dive straight in? How did you get started in this wonderful world of languages, and what was your first language you learned?
Hi, Chris. Thank you for the invitation. Oh, it's a long story. I have already a few years behind me. So when it started, I was born in Bratislava in Czechoslovakia. So my mother tongue is Slovak and my father tongue is Czech. Before I went to school, I actually didn't see a lot of difference between these two languages. So listened to both of them and spoke a mixture of them. And then later as a child, I've heard a lot of Hungarian, but unfortunately never learned it correctly. Then we went in summers, we went to Yugoslavia for summer holiday with my family. And I remember when I was 5 or 6, we had a tourist book with a small dictionary of about 200 words you usually need as a tourist. And I remember I wanted to go to a shop and ask for a bread. And there were just a few Slovak words translated into Croatian words. So I just built a Slovak phrase with the thought, okay, if a word is not in a dictionary, it has to be the same like in Slovak. So I just told the Slovak sentence with a few words replaced by Croatian ones. But the shopkeeper, he understood. And, Czechoslovak. Okay. He gave me the bread I wanted. Since I lived in Bratislava, this is at the border of Austria and Hungary, and all we could get from Austria was the television signal. So we had directly, we could watch the Austrian television directly at the border, because there were no satellites or cable TV. We are speaking about mid-80s. So as a child, I watched the Austrian television quite a lot, because there were some cartoons that were not on the Czechoslovak television. I remember always on Tuesday evening at 5, there was a fat guy sitting there speaking about some stories. I didn't understand the word, but from time to time there was Tom and Jerry. So I was just looking forward to it. And for us, German was a foreign language, like a very strange language we didn't really understand. And it comes actually from the Slavic name of the Germans. You know, in most Slavic languages, Germany or Germans are called Nemets. It means someone who is mute, who can't speak, so who doesn't speak your language. And in the kindergarten with my friends, let's speak some German. And we were just talking some gibberish without any sense. So later, it was still in the 80s, I went to an English language primary school. There was one like that in our city, where we started to learn English before we started learning Russian. Actually, in Czechoslovakia, it was obligatory to learn Russian from the age of 10. But with English, we started already at the age of 8. Now I understand it very well, but in those times it was so strange that our teacher, she didn't want us to tell her Mrs. Comrade, because all teachers were comrades. No, I'm Mrs. and you don't tell me a comrade. So, and then when I was 10, I started learning Russian because everybody had to. But it was in 89, and then came the Velvet Revolution, and suddenly we stopped learning Russian, and all Russian teachers became English, German, or Slovak language teachers. But this 1 year was enough to learn the writing system, the Cyrillic alphabet, and to learn some grammar. Actually, it is quite similar to Slovak. So if someone is speaking Russian, we can understand it quite well. It's just the vocabulary is somehow different. Later came French. I went to a French bilingual high school in Bratislava. This was a nice system in Slovakia. There were a few high schools, bilingual high schools, where you could learn English, German, French, Italian, Spanish, or different such high schools. In the first year, you had to learn the language, like 20 hours per week of language learning. And then in the following years, we had other subjects like biology, mathematics, physics, chemistry, and so on in the language. So that's the way how I learned French. And I remember I was the only one in our class who never learned French before. There are some strange details in French that I couldn't understand why they work like this. I never knew before, for example, that the French, they can count only until 60. And after 69, there is 6010, 6011. But the system was great. We really learned, and after 5 or 6 months, we went to France for 1 week to visit some random French families. And imagine that after study of French for 5 months, you come to some family, they don't speak anything else than French, and you spend with them a whole week. They prepare dinner. There is some sort of meat, and I ask, "What's that?" And they say, "C'est du lapin." And okay, lapin, it sounds like la is always the article. Pain, it must be some sort of a meat. So I just, okay, un instant. I went to my room, took my French Slovak dictionary, and then sought for this word. And pain, it can be written in any way in French. So I just saw all the possibilities, and I didn't find anything similar. Like pain, it can be a bread, but of course it was a piece of meat. And I couldn't find it, so I just gave them the book, and they said, no, it's not like P, it starts with L. So lapin, it's already the article, there is no article, lapin is the whole book. That was the first and the last time I used the dictionary in France and just put it away. And then since then, I just always ask when I didn't understand something, and they explained it to me. Also, I could explain everything with a few words.
How did you, I think it's interesting that, of course, you had many languages around you naturally, but whose idea was it to go to, first of all, an English school and then another bilingual school with French and German? Was that, were you that excited about languages, or was it your parents' idea to give you a bit of a...
In that age, it were my parents, because they had some friends who had children at the same schools a year before. So it was. I just tried to get there. These were state schools, so they didn't cost anything. It was just you had to get there, pass some exams at the beginning.
I think that could be great to roll out globally, schools in other languages, or maybe a year of each or something. Because kids, kids are so receptive at the young ages, you know, they don't really care what language they play in, especially when they're really young. But
well, it was not really young. The English was at 8, 9.
Oh, you were still playing. You can play football then, or whatever. You can play some sport. That you don't need to speak to play any sport with the friends in school.
Yeah, no, but this is it was really quite intensive way because at the high school after we had other subjects like mathematics and biology and so on in French. So there are even many things from the high school that I know them, like know how to tell them in French, but not in Slovak.
It can be tough. I remember I did an English high school diploma, and mm-hmm. I remember just doing maths and physics in another language, which is so confusing because there's not necessarily a link between how to say it in my case Danish and then in English. And it's just, it really made it all a lot harder. So I can really understand how you must have felt as well going into, I mean, French must be, as a Slovak, must be really foreign.
It's a completely different language, of course, yeah. But the infrastructure was great because the French government sent us all the books. There was an Institut Français, a French institute in Bratislava, where we could borrow books and videos and CDs at the time. And we also went to France once a year for a week. Also, the other families from France, they came to Bratislava. Oh. They had no interest in learning Slovak, of course, but for those children of 15, 16, 17 years of age, it was, of course, great to get away from the family and to get to a country where beer is so cheap.
I've seen that, yeah. It's dangerous. So what happened next? Where did you go after the French and German bilingual school? Was that a high school program?
It was a high school. It was a high school. So until high school diploma, mm-hmm. And we did actually the French diploma. My German was still almost non-existent. Actually, when you live in Bratislava and you speak the Slovak, the local dialect, it is a mixture of German, Hungarian, Czech, and Slovak. So if you are from Bratislava and you speak the local dialect, you understand a lot of German. You don't understand the grammar because we use the Slovak grammar, but we use many, many German, Hungarian, and Czech words. So this is also a dialect that sounds so strange to other Slovaks who don't really like it, but whereas it is useful because we can understand quite a lot of Hungarian and German. So, but my German was like, we went to France, but passing through Austria and Germany, I just didn't understand anything. But I was not able to speak to local people.
Okay. In Germany and in
Austria. And also in Bratislava, we were at the border to Austria. We went to Austria from time to time, but I didn't really speak the language. It was much, much, much later. Then I went, after the high school, I went to a university in France because with the high school diploma, it was actually no problem to get there. And it was in Lyon, and it was the place where I learned Polish.
Okay, of course.
Yeah, at the university residence, my roommate was from Poland. During 2 years, and at the beginning he spoke Polish, I spoke Slovak, and after 1 year he spoke Slovak and I spoke Polish. There are quite many false friends between Polish and Slovak, so at the beginning of course it was funny to compare some words that mean something completely different, like mieszkać in Polish means to live somewhere, and in Slovak it means to come late somewhere. Also, if you're in Slovakia on the shops, you see text like fresh bread, fresh milk, and the word fresh in Slovak is čerstvý, and in Polish it means something old.
So Polish
people, they don't like to buy food in Slovakia because they are not sure whether it is fresh.
It's all opposite.
Yeah. And then it was possible to get as an Erasmus student abroad from France. So I chose Germany finally to learn some German. At the beginning, it was quite difficult. I remember the first day, the mayor of the city, he organized a welcoming party for all foreign students that came there in the year, in the city hall. And he was speaking for half an hour. I don't remember much, but his last sentence was, "Ich wünsche euch, dass ihr euch in der beziehungsweise in die Stadt verliebt." You understand?
And or it's a good German word.
I wish you, I wish you to fall in love with the city or in the city.
Yes.
Huh? But that means
Beziehungsweise is nice. I like that.
beziehungsweise respective. No, since beziehungsweise is like or.
And or, yeah.
And or,
Usually.
yeah.
It's a
Yeah.
great word.
So with my Bratislava dialect, I could understand every word, but didn't see the difference between in der Stadt und in die Stadt, which
Ah,
means
right.
to fall in love with the city or in the city.
Yes, it's quite a
Yeah.
significant difference, yeah.
Yeah. But after later it worked much better. But actually, I live in a region that says wir können alles außer Hochdeutsch. Which is the region we can do everything except for standard German. Standard German is not really spoken here.
Right. That's quite confusing for people like me who pretty much only learned standard German. I had
Yeah, I know.
a Swiss roommate for a while. That's a very confusing dialect, I find.
Yeah, Swiss.
It's not easy.
Not so easy to understand them.
No. And so did you fall in love with the city?
Oh yes, I still live here, and it's quite nice to live here. The weather is nice, except for summer, and summer it is too hot here.
It's too hot, yeah.
Yeah,
Well,
but it's a yeah.
we all
Sorry.
have that problem right now with the too hot, at least this summer. It's been,
Yeah.
even in England, it's been too hot, so it's everywhere now.
Yeah.
So
That's all. That's everything.
that's it. Well, so one thing that comes to mind is these you seem to have kind of taken all opportunities you could. Well, some of them might be, maybe you didn't even take the decisions yourself, but you definitely got all the places you could get to keep growing and keep learning more languages. When did you start to, or when you were done with university, how was it to become, or suddenly have to do it yourself, or suddenly did you keep working on your old languages, or how did you start adding new ones after that?
Everyone was a different. Every one of them was very different. I remember at the university in France, I took a course of Spanish. I was the only foreigner in that class, and the teacher, she really enjoyed it that I was there because she taught some word and she asked me to repeat it before the French students had to repeat it. So, for example, in Spanish, I am a foreigner. Soy extranjero. If I tell it with Slovak accent, soy extranjero, it sounds almost like Spanish. But for French students, usually they read it somehow like something like extranjero. And
Yeah.
yeah. But, so with Spanish, later I just tried to learn Spanish when I discovered podcasts. So
Okay.
podcast like not a language learning podcast, but on the Spanish national radio there was popular science podcast every week, Vanguardia de la Ciencia. It was every week, it was 1 hour about science, but popular science. And it was really well made. Like there were biographies of some scientists with music, with voices of people speaking for them. I really enjoyed it, and I listened to that every day, also older episodes, half an hour every day. And after 1 2 years, I just started speaking Spanish.
Super
Then
nice.
came Italian. Unfortunately, I started it too early. So learning Spanish and Italian at the same time is a very bad idea.
Okay. What happened?
I just mixed. I could understand both languages, but when I spoke one language, I just started mixing words from the other language.
Hey guys, just taking a quick break from today's episode to talk about Glossika, which is the show's sponsor. So Glossika provide audio programs in 50 languages, and they're all based on spaced repetition. And Glossika has a really laid-back approach when it comes to memorization. So typically, language learning apps are going to be focused on kind of bombarding the short-term memory, like Anki or Memrise. You'll keep doing it and eventually will pass over to the long-term memory, but it can seem a little bit stressful because you have to do a lot of clicking, there's a lot of testing, so it doesn't really, in that sense, give you the calmness that the memory sometimes wants. Glossika is a little bit different in that sense, in that when you do the reps, which are the name for the daily training that it suggests you do, which is one 20-minute session, roughly, you get a lot of repetition, but you don't have to click anything, you don't have to type anything. There are tools and games available to supplement these reps, but what you basically want to be doing is just hands off and just study these reps, and you will slowly improve your vocabulary, improve your listening of the language, and also your grammatical understanding. And this is all done through context, so you don't have to do any actual studying or thinking. It's just basically a really nice approach, especially if you're like me, a little bit on the lazy side when it comes to studying. So if you want to give Glossika a try, go to tryglossika.com, and there's a free 1,000 rep trial you can get started on. And otherwise, it's a paid monthly subscription where you get access to all 50 languages. So it's perfect for the aspiring polyglot as well. And for now, let's go back to the episode with Miro. All right. And then in, I guess, where our story starts is in 2004, I think.
14?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. 2014, yeah. I was going a little bit too far back. I haven't been podcasting for 17 years now, I don't know. So the first I heard about the sort of polyglot movement and even the word polyglot, I think I might have seen it before, but I probably didn't even think what it meant. But then I think I was just kind of surfing the web, and I found Benny's blog about how he was traveling and learning languages. Yeah, and
the same
thing. It looked like a really cool lifestyle. And then I was like, I want to find out how people do this. And so the podcast was started in March 2014. Mm-hmm. And the first Polyglot gathering, which was in Berlin. Well, sorry, we should probably mention that the first Polyglot conference, which more or less started the whole thing, I guess, was in fall of 2013 in Budapest.
Yeah,
I hadn't even heard of it. I think mm-hmm. I read a post about after the event had finished. I was like, yeah, missed it. So in 2014, and I came into the Polyglot gathering, and I think I had released about 10 episodes, maybe 7, maybe less. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And it was I didn't know anyone at the conference. I talked to, obviously interviewed a few people, and I had, Chris Huff. I talked to a little bit on Facebook. But when I came to the conference, the Polyglot gathering, I didn't really know anything or anyone really. But one night, maybe it's already on the first day, I don't remember, but you came over and you showed me your phone. And you had a lot of podcasts. It was very clear that you really embraced that format, and I guess you use it for everything, even on learning and information, news, and everything. But there was my terrible logo of Actual Fluency in its very early days. And I just want to, first of all, just thank you for that moment. That was a very pure and beautiful moment as a fledgling podcaster, not really sure.
Chris, I have to interrupt you. You were the first podcast author that I met in person. So in my list of so many podcasts, it was for the first time I could speak to the author of the podcast and tell him, hey, you are doing a great job.
Yeah, and like I said, I just want to thank you for that. I mentioned it before. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but especially when you start something new, the support of people means everything. So when you came over, and I could see you had more than just my podcast, so I knew you weren't just comparing me to nothing. You know, I knew that. I knew that you'd be well. And also, to be fair, you have given me a lot of good points of feedback, which I've tried to take forward where possible. So that's also something that I really, really appreciate. But more about the just at that point, starting out having absolutely no idea what I was doing at that conference, to you coming over, it really set the tone for the whole thing. And honestly, it's probably the reason, one of the few individual reasons that I kept doing it, the podcast, for so long, but also came back to the gathering, had a great time the first time, just having an ally, you know, in this kind of, you know, when you go to the conference, there's 200 strangers you haven't met. Like, even Judith didn't know who I was, even though I interviewed her 3 weeks earlier. I don't blame her. You know, I'm just a kid, you know, I'm just a nobody. But that was rough. It was kind of like camp. You know, you go to a camp and there's 200 unknown faces there. And at the last day, of course, everyone is happy. Everyone's friends. Everyone has found kind of people with similar interests. But this was on the first day, I'm quite sure, that we did this. So it really it really meant a lot to me, and it still means a lot to me today. And I still call you my biggest fan. So thank you for that, first and foremost. And you were volunteering, and you have been for a few years. We can talk about that in a second. But what was your story on finding the sort of Polyglot community, the whole movement that we've become such a big part of now?
Mm-hmm. But I didn't know so many people who had languages as a hobby. So for me, it was also reading blogs, watching some YouTube videos online. And then I have heard about this Polyglot conference in Budapest. So I went there just as a normal participant. And then it was my first and last Polyglot conference until now. I didn't do any other. But the gatherings, there were five of them. I went to all five of them and even co-organized or helped the organization in the past three or four of them. And it was great because I knew that even if the talks, there are some new talks, some interesting talks, many talks are not always new for someone who is coming there for the fifth time. But I knew that as an organizer, I can just help a lot. I have always something to do. As an organizer, you have always a lot of things to do. You don't go simply to follow some talks. And also that people recognize you. And it's really a lot of fun and a great occasion to help such an event.
Right. And you've done a great job. And I want to thank you for that. Like I said earlier, I've been part of four out of those five, three in Berlin and one in Bratislava. And the organization has always blown me away. Like, even the first one, I thought, because you kind of expect things to go wrong at least the first time. But honestly, the problems that were in any of these gatherings, they were just so tiny. Like, it was completely minor issues. Like, you know, oh, it's too hot, or, you know, there's just nothing. Like, even everything was just running so smoothly, and you were a big part of that.
We are not responsible for the weather, I'm sorry.
Right, exactly, yeah. But it was really hot one year, I remember. Everyone was dying. But anyway, the reason that I also brought it up, not just to talk about the community as whole, is obviously to keep harping on this idea of community and kind of having a sense of belonging, maybe to this hobby, where it can be quite an isolating and an individual affair. So I just wanted to bring that up. And for people who are maybe not too familiar with these conferences, there are quite a few of them now, actually, you can go to. So if you're in America, for instance, North America, there's a conference in Montreal that's every year, Langfest. And in Central Europe, you've got Bratislava. Is that coming to Bratislava next year?
Actually, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to announce that information.
well, the secrets are is still there, but there will be a gathering, I presume. We just don't know where or when. And then you've got the conference, which this year is in Slovenia, which is not too far away, I guess. Mm-hmm. And what am I missing? Is that it? Gathering, Langfest, conference. I feel like I'm missing one. Anyway, that's at least three big ones.
You know,
And
these are the big ones.
Yes, these are the majors of the language learning community. And I've been talking endlessly on the podcast about how good these events are. And to me, it's not really about the languages either, you know, because for me, it's more like a chance to socialize, meet some friends, some like-minded people. There are a lot of creative people there as well. Lots of bloggers and other fellow podcasters as well. So it's a good opportunity to meet up and chat about how things have gone. And after going to so many of them, I know like half the people every time, which is so different from the first time I was there where I didn't know anyone, which was a funny experience. And I obviously have had the fortune of talking a few of the events. And I know you have as well, which is a great kind of feeling of giving a little bit back, sharing a little bit of unique perspective. And I just recommend everyone just go to these things. At least try it once. You know, if you hate it, you don't have to come back. But I think most people get quite hooked on them.
Maybe something that, of course, the conferences, gatherings, and so they are great. You can meet the most enthusiastic language learners in the world because they go there, of course. But there is for people who don't think that, or maybe if they live a little bit further and don't want to travel for a few days to some other place. What I find quite good is our meetups. So there is this online system, meetup.com, where you can organize a meetup on any topic. So I go regularly in my city, I go to technical IT topics, IT meetups, but there are also language meetups. So people from some region, they just meet once a month, once a week in some city, and for evening in a restaurant, in a bar, and everybody pays for their consumption, and they speak. They can create tandems if they want, and this is something that doesn't cost anything. Of course, you will probably not meet anyone who comes from the other part of the world, but for local people, it is a great possibility. A few years ago, I was in northern Spain, in Basque country, for a conference, like IT conference. And on one evening, I didn't have anything to do, so I just thought online whether there are some meetups, and there was a international meetup for people who want to practice other languages, and I checked, okay, there are 16 people, all of them are Spanish, great, I'm going to practice my Spanish. I get there, and they see me, and they say, oh, great, we can practice our English. Huh? Of course, all of them wanted to speak English to me. I said, no, I'm not probably the best person to speak English to, but maybe we could switch to Spanish. And then it was a nice evening. Probably not travel to other part of Europe to practice some language.
Right. And this is especially good, I find, in the bigger cities. Budapest had tons of meetups when I was living there. I went to the German meetup a few times. That was actually quite fun. And I went to, that's in London. There's also quite a lot of meetups, of course, a ridiculous size city. They have the Languages of London, which has been a little bit quiet lately, but they used to have regular meetups as well in pubs just to meet and have a chat and a beer. So that's a good tip. And of course, we've got the internet. We're talking over the internet right now. You can find great resources online as well. Tutoring services for very cheap, or you can, you know, go to language exchanges, something like that. So there's endless opportunity to gather and meet new people, even if you can't travel to these places, because honestly, there are some of them that are quite remote and quite hard to get to. For instance, Montreal in summer, it's very expensive from Europe. I think it's probably about 700 euros return for just the flights, and then you need accommodation and food and everything. So I can only imagine that's probably the same for the American citizens or Canadian citizens who want to come over to us and join the gathering and the conference, which is on this continent this year. I have a suspicion that the conference next year will not be in Europe, but we'll see. It's all about what Alex and Richard decide to do, and I don't think they know themselves yet, maybe. So there's definitely no secret there that's being kept, because I'm not sure they know. But maybe we could just chat a little bit about your method or how you work on your languages, because if there's anything that's always impressed me is this, you know, the amount of languages that you have on, you know, the badge where you get in conference. When I look at your badge, I get lost because I lose count as how many there are. So I know obviously the various levels. I know you're not the C2 in all of them or anything, but
No.
how's your method sort of developed as you've grown over the years to more and more languages, and how would you say you use most of your language learning time these days?
All of these languages was different. Actually, the only language I learned systematically at school was French, but all the rest was like random listening to reading. And the polyglots, they like to present their secret tips on learning languages, the best methods. I have no best methods because I enjoy just switching between the methods, trying out. I also already tried GoldList and Anki and Closemaster and Duolingo and Memrise. There were some positives, some negatives. So Duolingo is a nice game, but when you are repeating some lesson, it always asks you the questions from the same lesson. So it means if you have like two grammatical cases, like something positive and something negative, there is one exercise for the positive and one exercise for the negative. And then you know you are repeating the sentences. Okay, now it will be always positive, so I don't have to use the negative case.
No, Duolingo is I'm not sure what to think of it. I can't keep it up. Every time I try to play with it for a long time, I get bored, and if I don't do it for a long time, I feel like I've made very limited progress, and I just don't like the way that it's set up. I think it should be a more contained where you just press a button and you learn the next bit instead of choosing like these lessons. It's so abrupt in a way. But anyway, I mean, that's a big discussion that's been going on for a while. What I can say though, and I'm sure would agree with me, is that Duolingo is definitely helping people to learn languages, but
It is accessible.
hopefully it's helping people to find out more. So maybe they don't become fluent from Duolingo, but maybe that lights the fire that gets them to find the podcasts or the books or the courses or the teachers that will eventually make them fluent. So it's for me, it's more of like a, it's kind of like a trap, you know, that you want to get people in so they can see how great it is, not necessarily succeed, but then they go out elsewhere to plug the holes, so to speak.
Memrise, it offers much more. I tried to learn Basque with Memrise because I went to this IT conference in the Basque country, and Basque was my first language that is smaller than my mother tongue, than Slovak. All other languages I have learned have more speakers than Slovak does, but Basque is smaller. And with my very limited Basque, I just tried to use Memrise, and I discovered so many mistakes, so many errors, typos. And it means that with my limited Basque, I could rediscover these typos. I don't know how many typos were there in the rest of the exercise. So I abandoned it.
Yeah,
Cool.
it's user generated. That's the problem. Most of it
That's it.
is user generated. They only have a few self-made courses for the top five languages or something.
The same with Closemaster. They use the sentences from Tatoeba, but Tatoeba is a website where you can translate in a natural way the sentences that are already there into your languages. Of course, there are also errors for writing.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea of Closemaster. I've used it quite a bit, and I do find it generally useful, but it really suffers from the corpus, because it's just you
Which
kind of.
languages are you using for?
I was using it for Russian, mostly, and the problem is, well, there are several problems, but the biggest problem is the corpus, because not all sentences from that Tatoeba corpus is useful. And they don't necessarily make sense. And also, there was a lot of proper names. So there was like, it was teaching me like John and James and Jake. You know, it's
No,
like,
all guys are called Tom in
oh, yeah, Tom as well.
Closemaster. Tom, yeah.
Yeah, Tom. And then the other problem I have is that the pronunciation, I mean, the translation is just not trustworthy because the words can have so many meanings and the sentences themselves as well. So what they need to do is they need to hire a bunch of native speakers on a contract. It could be a small, relatively small task. What they need to do is go through all the sentences. I think there's about 50,000 of them. I mean, that's a lot of sentences, but it wouldn't take more than a month, surely. Just read them. Do they make sense? And is the translation trustworthy? Okay, keep. Does the translation not make sense and it's not trustworthy, get rid of it? Because there were so many sentences I had to just block. Because it's just...
You don't have to block it. You can go to tatoeba.org, and this is like a wiki of translations. And this website, this is actually where Closemaster takes their sentences
from. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, so you mean I should go there to find out what the sentence really...
I'm not sure whether the author of Closemaster is taking the updates from Tatoeba.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I'm not saying that the translation is wrong. I'm just saying that the translation, it might translate literally sometimes. Because it's like, it could be a correct translation, but in the example given, the word might not be used in that original translation. And sometimes I don't know if they take it per word basis or what they do, but I've definitely noticed a lot of kind of where you just think that that's a really weird way to say that, and I don't think that would be very useful for me. We agree that the platform could be great. They just need to focus on quality of the material. And what's the other problem? Well, of course, the pronunciation as well. You don't really get that much with the engine. Was it
in some languages you don't need to hear the pronunciation in English and French? Yes, but in all other languages you can just always read it correctly.
Yeah, well, I don't mind it either way. I just think the getting a little bit more input is also advantageous, even if
you just mentioned now two points that are important for people like me who learn a foreign language not from their mother tongue, because learning other languages from Slovak, there are not so many materials, so I already use English, German or French. There are two points. There are the translations and the pronunciation. A book or edition of Asimov that most polyglots really like. I'm also using quite a lot of them. And for example, for Chinese, I started learning Chinese with German Asimil. There were one thing is this, the way how Asimil writes the pronunciation. They write it in the way how a learning person would read it in their proper language.
Yeah.
If I learn from German, I can read any German word correctly. But if they write a word that is a Chinese word and that looks like German, and I read it in German and it should sound like a Chinese word, then I have really problems with that, because I cannot read German words that are not German words.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that,
so the,
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so the International Phonetic Alphabet would be a better, but this is probably not something that most of their customers are going to use. And no. The other thing is the translation. After a few chapters or lessons in Chinese for Germans in Asimil, there was some word that I didn't understand very well the translation. I didn't, and I know the German word, but I was not sure which meaning they wanted to tell us. So I live next to the French border. Next week, I went to France. I bought the French Asimil for Chinese, for French. And then I took both books at the same time because they are the content is identical. And then I always like L2 is the second language for me is German. Another second language for me is French. And I just tried to overpose the German and the French word and to try to guess the meaning. Sometimes this is the advantage when you speak already a few languages, that you can try to understand it in a few of your languages, and then okay, I know exactly what it means.
It's like triangulating in a way.
Triangulating, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I use that as well. I have the German Asimil for Hungarian, for instance, which is very helpful for just practicing a bit of that as well as learning a new one. But I don't know if I don't know. Sometimes I feel a little bit annoyed that all these apps and softwares don't really get all the way. You know, it's like they come very close to a really good way to learn languages, but they all have their flaws, you know. So I guess the solution is just to use a lot of different resources, or like just go back to the basics. With it sounds like you enjoy reading and listening a lot, just getting a lot of input. Do you do any other things you like to do? Do you have a lot of tutoring, for instance, or are you mostly using the
no tutoring at all? For some languages, when I think that I have already reached some good level, I have already the book of The Little Prince from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry in that language. I have now about 50 or 60 of them. So, of course, most of them are in languages that I'm never going to read. Some of the books, I even don't know how to open it, which way, because the characters are strange to me. Fortunately, there are always the pictures, so I know how they are oriented. And then I try to read it because it's easy. The words are repeating themselves, and I know the story. And Little Prince, 60 books of Little Prince, they enter one bookcase.
Mm.
If you try to read War and Peace or to collect them, they will take much more place.
Yeah, some people like to use something like Harry Potter or similar series where they know the story as well. I've been doing that a little bit as well. I find that actually quite useful, because even if you don't feel totally comfortable reading in that language, the idea that you know the story will mean that you kind of keep going, because you know what's supposed to happen, you know what's actually happening. So that's kind of I feel like that's a pretty good trick, actually, because it's very hard to start reading, I find, because either you have kind of basic, like kids books, basically, that's very simple and they don't really help that much. And then you have native level stuff, which is just impossible and takes thousands and thousands of words or lexical elements. And the bridging the gap is just really hard, I find, because graded readers are great to a degree, but you have to find one that's exactly your level. That's really hard. Because if you have like a 100 word graded reader and the next step up is 500 and you're at like 250, then the 100 is going to be too easy and the 500 is going to be too hard.
Yeah. And this is also with the way graded reader, okay, this is monolingual usually. So you can use a dictionary. I prefer using monolingual dictionaries with example sentences. But with the translations, the problem is that, not the translation, but with the explanations of grammar. If you know some language, for example, if you are English speaker, English native English speaker, and someone wants to explain you the French way of saying tu and vous, like the formal, informal, grammar, how it works, tu and vous, they have to explain it.
Yeah.
To German, Spanish, and Italian, they also have to understand it because it works a little bit differently. But in Czech and Slovak, it is grammatically identical to the French. So at high school in French, they told us, okay, it's the same like in Slovak. This is tu, vous, and we just learned the words. We didn't have to learn the concept because the concept is identical.
So right.
The more languages you understand, there are less unexpected surprises in the new language.
So a way to get better at learning languages is to keep learning more languages. That's a good.
And then you take like some general languages like Esperanto or Latin. Esperanto. There are always these gatherings. You speak Esperanto. I said, no, I don't speak Esperanto. I don't like speaking it. I understand it, because for me Esperanto, it is based on, most words are from English, French, German, Spanish, Italian, and Russian.
Yeah.
I understand all these six languages. So if you tell me a word in Esperanto, very probably I can understand it.
Yeah. But
on the other way around, it's more complicated, because Esperanto, it chooses these like random words from random languages. If you take two animals that are the closest or very important to humankind, it's a dog and horse. Dog, okay, it could be like dogo or chieno or sobako or hundo or perro is hundo from German. Right. But it is, but the horse is not horso or ferdo. It's not ferdo. It's not from German. It's cevalo.
Right.
No. So this is now a few weeks ago I started studying Latin a little bit more. Then I think, why didn't Esperanto take actually the complete Latin with super simplified grammar and simplified syntax, but take actually the Latin words?
Right. That would have been easier, yeah.
It would be much more logical because it would be based on a language and it would be like simple Latin and not a mixture of five, six different European languages where you never know which one language they wanted to take.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's the struggle with Esperanto is really you don't know, and there's going to be so much interference for many Europeans because even if they don't know that many languages, they will still have knowledge, or they would have heard some German, some French, some Spanish probably. So when they have to guess a word, they might go through a whole list like you just did before, and it makes it quite confusing. But
yeah, so that's why I don't speak.
No, you don't speak. I'm the same, but just because I'm incompetent at it. But I don't know what I think about Esperanto. I think it's good for some. It's good for pedagogical reasons, like getting monolinguals excited about language, especially maybe kids. If you give them a little bit of Esperanto, maybe they get kind of excited about how easy it is to learn a language. That I can get on board with. The idea that Esperanto is going to be like the new language of the world to bridge every culture and community.
Yes, but
that's a tough sell for me.
You have to extrapolate it a little bit. Like, see how many years Esperanto is here, how far is it, and...
Yeah. Exactly. But anyway, Miro, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today and hear a little bit more about your language story. I mean, you're really one of the most incredible learners at the gathering, and also volunteers. Thank you for doing so much work for the community and always, you know, putting on the games and making sure all the logistical and arrangements are taken care of.
Thank you for the podcast. Over those years, it was always inspiring to meet virtually so many language learners and to learn so much. I also learned about so many methods from your podcast and tried out them. And it was always, actually, learning languages is not a target. It's a road. Then meeting other people at the polyglot events, it's great, but with the languages you can do much more. I'm going sometimes to IT conferences and giving talks, and actually this is even more impressive, I don't know, but more inspiring. The talk is even on YouTube, called The One Brain, Keyboard, One Editor, and in this talk I'm trying to show to people how to type in most European languages on single keyboard layout. If you imagine you can type English on any keyboard layout, but if you have German and French, you have always to switch. And this is not only the QWERTY or QWERTY keys that are somewhere else, but all the rest, like dot and parentheses and brackets and everything is somewhere else. This is in my talk at the beginning, I'm just explaining, comparing the keyboard layouts of different countries or different languages and speaking in that respective language. And people, some of them learn how to do it, but most of them come after to me and ask, how can I learn so many languages? that is actually inspiring, because you are not going to polyglot events, you are going to IT events of people, and IT and foreign languages, it is very good combination. Like, not many people do both things. And that is where I find it the most inspiring. Like, polyglots should go to the places where people meet who share the hobbies or their professional interests and inspire people in learning languages.
Yeah. To learn languages. Yeah. That's a really good point. Because you don't want it to be about the learning itself. You want it to be about what you can do with it.
And yeah, exactly.
Like, it's a funny... It's a funny world we live in because I can go to the gathering and people would say, Chris, your languages are looking a little bit thin there. Not that they say that. That's mostly my self-confidence speaking. But if I go to my job, I'm a language genius. They're like, well, how did you do this? And I'm like, I didn't do anything. This is all upbringing. You know, this is just a random coincidence. But sometimes we can get lost in this kind of sea of, oh, we need to learn 10 languages and talk about the best methods for learning the conjunctive or whatever. You know, it's about using it in practice, isn't it? It's about getting out there, connecting with people, and use the languages, whether it's to talk to pretty girls at a club or further your career or make new friends in meetups around the world.
You have to go once a year to a polyglot event and then get back to the real world. And also what's interesting is to keep the badges from the polyglot gathering. We can put the stickers with the languages, with the levels we have, and then just compare it from one year to another. They say, okay, in this year, I could just move this one language from A to B.
Mm. Yeah, or I can compare, I can say, oh, those are the five same languages I put on last year. But in that case, we're quite different. But anyway, Mira, it's really been a pleasure. I hope that we get a chance to do another episode at some point, maybe after the next gathering. Who knows where that might be? But thank you so much for coming on for now and for being my biggest fans over the years. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris, for having me. Thank you, Mike.
Very welcome.
Yep. Bye.
This episode was brought to you with support from Glossika Spaced Repetition Audio Programs. To get your free 1,000 reps and explore the more than 50 languages available, go to tryglossika.com.